And welcome to another edition of the In Context podcast. Today, I'm with another good friend of mine. It's Aaron Reyes. How are you doing, Aaron?
I'm doing well, Ian, man. Joy to be on the podcast with you, bro.
Yeah, it's great to have you, brother. And just share a little bit about who you are and what you're doing at the moment, brother.
Well, my name is Aaron Reyes. We've been here in the UK, in Birmingham specifically, for about 8 or 9 months. We're a family that comes from Texas. That's where I was born in El Paso. My wife is a Midwest gal, born in Minnesota, or born in South Carolina, but grew up in Minnesota. And yeah, we've been here ministering. We're a family of four. We have two kids, a 10-year-old son and a 7-year-old daughter. And about myself, I grew up in a very mixed background. I grew up in a mixture of a Latino context, but also with a little bit of just Texan overall American. Having been born in El Paso, which is a border town, where you're getting the mixture and the blessings of both America and Mexico as a culture, in the very Spanglish environment, a bicultural. My parents, biologically, my father is a Mexican. It was a Mexican immigrant. My mother was a white American woman. So much of what shaped my life was those earliest years of being alive. We spent our first couple of years in Mexico itself, but my biological parents did separate, and so that did leave my mom as a single mother in El Paso. And so I can share more about how that might tie into even how we got connected to Medhurst. I don't know if you want to jump there, but in terms of other things, I'm a jock. I love sports. I played American football for many years in the U.S., starting from age 12 all the way to 24. I still have the wounds of American football too, from shoulder injuries, knee injuries, and certainly concussions. But I'm also a nerd, and so I love studying. I didn't realize I love studying until I became a Christian. But I do like to study and to think. God has given us a mind, and yeah, brother, we've been here for 9 months, still learning a lot that we're learning about the UK. There are a lot of similarities but differences as well than the US. But yeah, that's a little bit about me.
Well, I grew up watching a lot of American movies, and I know all about jocks and nerds. And most of my experience will have been with white Americans or Afro Americans and Afro Caribbean kind of influences. With looking at the reggae and the music, or like Boys in the Hood, and that would probably be more LA or New York City, looking at stuff from New York. And very little about El Paso until Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. Is that a similar area? I know there's El Paso sauce, but what kind of area is El Paso like?
So Breaking Bad, I believe it takes place in New Mexico, is the primary location, right? I'm not as in that, but the American Southwest is what that's called, where it's desert climate, very arid, and El Paso, like much of New Mexico and even Arizona, and has this, again, bicultural feel, where heavily influenced by the Latino, particularly Mexican history, the Spanish language and those cultures and customs, but then also just white Americans. And El Paso, I'm not an El Paso scholar, so I don't know the history of its economics, but it is a big military town as well. And so most of the non-Mexicanos and non-white folks that I met, so whether they were Black Americans or Asian Americans, that I saw growing up, was because of the military base. It was a large army base there. And I'm sure I had to do something with cattle. Don't quote me on that. But there was, you mentioned that movie with Ice Cube back in the early 90s. I remember, maybe not watching, I was too young, but seeing clips of older people watch that.
Oh, thank you. Just remind me that I'm a lot older than you, Aaron.
No, not like that. Well, here's what it was. And so I'll tie this into my upbringing. So when my mom was a single mother, we lived in Section 8 housing, and what we call the projects. It's the U.S. equivalent of council estate, council schemes here in the U.K. And so having grown up, that my mom worked 2-3 jobs. And so I was like a latchkey kid, man, where on a given day, I look back thinking, man, God bless parents back then. I don't think they had any idea where their kids were. And so I would just wander with my friends, and there was this one kid who was a few blocks over, and I think it was he was similar age as me. It was his older sister who was a teenager, and she was watching the movie, and I just remember some of those scenes, particularly from the gang violence, and where it intersect where El Paso intersects with that is there are gangs there as well, and you don't have as much of the cartel influence as you do now, but there were gangs there. And so I remember as a kid seeing gangs fighting on the streets of, this was before there was this proliferation of guns, but I remember there guys throwing bricks at windows as they're driving by. I remember seeing knife fights. I remember seeing, people getting jumped. You just see that from whether it was, and I don't remember the gang names, but they're associated with their colors, blue and red, and another one had a different color. And so I remember seeing that, and both intrigued as a little kid, like this is kind of entertaining when you're seeing people fight, but also terrified at the same time. And so you're stepping back and watching it. And then also as a kid, I remember thinking, this is dumb. Like, why are they doing this? And why would people want to aspire to this? But then when you grow up in a context where you something that I never once questioned, at least I don't remember questioning as a kid, is how come dad's not at home? And it's because in our apartment complex, most of the kids had no dads at home. And then there's something about the human psyche and where young men, young boys and young men particularly, that as we get older, we long for that male bond. We long for that communal gathering, a space where we're going to be accepted and challenged, but then also have a purpose. And that's where I also learned why gangs attract boys and young men, because it provides that community. It provides that space of acceptance of being challenged and being pushed, but then also giving a purpose and an identity. So that was my upbringing there. In the kindness of God, my mom did remarry my stepdad, and continuing with my personal journey, that they wanted a fresh start. My parents, having grown up in El Paso, at that time, you were seen as you made it if you moved out of El Paso. And my parents wanted something similar. They wanted a fresh start. And so that's when they moved to Austin, which is 500 or 600 miles east of El Paso. I know Texas is huge, right? I think you can fit six Englands in the state of Texas. But for us, it was like a paradise in Eden because it was so green in comparison with El Paso. And we went there. And my uncle was a university student at the University of Texas. And my parents said, hey, let's just go try this. They were probably in their late 20s, early 30s at the time. And I commend them for doing it. They didn't have any jobs lined up, no housing. We just moved there. And I think we spent a couple days at a motel until they found what we call a duplex here at there. And that's how they found jobs. And that was where Austin became. Now, I wasn't religious or spiritual at this time. Having grown up in Texas, where you're having this cultural background of both either Catholic and Baptist, I think we identified as Christians, even though we never went to church. Again, it was just cultural Christianity in America is so pronounced that you never go to church, but you'll still identify as Baptist or Catholic, or that's where we were. Other parts, and maybe it's Presbyterian or Methodist in other parts of the country, but we never went to church. And it wasn't until I was in high school, the equivalent of what, secondary school or college here, where I heard the gospel, and we had a campus ministry at our high school called the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. And one of my friends, my buddies, my mates, he invited me and all of our friends to go. And we were boys, like, yeah, I'll go check it out. They had snacks, and there was other they had games, so I went for the fun, the social aspect. And slowly over time, the Lord just began using that to soften my heart. And it wasn't until Monday of Holy Week of 2001, no, excuse me, of 2000. No, it was 2001. It was 2001. Monday of Holy Week of 2001, where the head coach, the coach who was leading our chapter, he played an animated version of the Passion of Christ, of Jesus proceed, the procession into Jerusalem, the crucifixion on Friday, and then the resurrection on Sunday. And he said, if you don't believe this, that this happened, you're not a Christian. And that shook me. because I just had assumed I was a Christian, right? We're here, we grow up, yeah, we might pray every once in a while before a meal. And God began to use the seeds of the gospel that were sown to just really press in me, and I felt this existential churning, this not angst, but this awakening of sorts, where I began to, God began connecting the dots in my mind of why Jesus was on the cross. Because growing up in a Catholic community, you see crucifixes everywhere, but I'd never once asked why. Why is that man? Why is Jesus on the cross? But it wasn't until that gospel presentation and the months that followed that the Holy Spirit began working in me, moving within me. And it wasn't until just a few months later that I just said, God, if you are who people say you are, I never cracked open the Bible, but I said, God, if you are who these people say you are, I want in. And it was that simple, not reluctant, but just a simple basic prayer that the Lord heard and answered. And then immediately I just felt a burden taken off. I felt lifted up. I felt free for the first time. And immediately there were dramatic transformations of desires. I had a desire to read the Bible, a desire to pray. I ended up going to church, which then my mom wanted to come to church, and then after that, and then my dad, and then my cousin, and then the Lord just used those moments to open up opportunities for the gospel for other members of my family. And so now I'm skipping ahead. It wasn't it. So shortly after that, I was immediately thrust into Christian leadership because I was a pretty good football player, American football player. I was a captain of the football team, and now I'm a Christian. The coach's like, "Hey, you're the leader of FCA now." Like, oh man, you sure? But doing that, man, my soul just came alive. The little I knew of the Bible, I'm trying to teach it, and probably was very rubbish and incoherent, but the Lord was using that, and that just awakened in me a desire of, oh, this I could I do this for a life? Could I be a teacher of God's word and care for people and evangelize? And so God began to nurture that desire until maybe I was 19 or 20, where I just had that conviction, that burden that Spurgeon says in his lecture to my students, that if you can do anything else, do that. Well, I couldn't fathom myself doing anything else. There was nothing that brought the joy, the passion, and I did have a conviction. I had a weightiness to seeing the brokenness of this world, to seeing Christian struggle, and I had a heart. I mean, looking back, I could see how God was nurturing a shepherd's heart within me, and so that's where then the Lord took me on a trajectory towards pastoral ministry, and then also then the training that I think was necessary for me to go through. And so, I'm just a little bit more about myself, bro.
So, what was it like then? You were a captain of a football team. With that, it gave you opportunities in Christian ministry, but I'll imagine it brought a lot of temptations along as well. Did it? What was it like going to college and being around what I'd imagine would be either a lot of nominal Christians or people who just didn't believe and were quite open about that?
So I went to university, and where I played college football as the Air Force Academy, which is based in Colorado Springs. And so it was a military academy that played American football at the Division I level, which is the highest level in college sports in the U.S. And I mean, there certainly were temptations, trials. It was almost exaggerated to the point where I just knew that, Aaron, you just got to stand strong. So, like, to give an example, me and my teammates, after practice or after game, we're showering, and they're talking about who they're going to hook up with this weekend. And then they see me there, and like, Aaron, what would you do? And, because they would say, you obviously, you don't want to order something. You maybe want to try it first before you order and purchase it. But that was their logic. I'm like, nah, man. I was like, I don't even know. I don't need to o try something before I know I'll like it. Like, I know I'm gonna like it. I don't need to do this. And then I tried to give my best defense for the Christian vision of sexual ethics. But that was just teasing me. I remember this one time we were taking a bus ride to the hotel from our school to the hotel before it was the day before a football match. One of my teammates said, "Hey, Aaron, I want you to look at something." And he throws a magazine in, and it was a Playboy or a Hustler or something like that in my lap. And And everyone's laughing, and I grab it. Man, y'all silly, man. Y'all need to chill. And I threw it back and whatnot. It never got to the point of hostility. It was just more so they saw it as, can we get Aaron to stumble? Can we get him to admit? And but by God's grace, man, I think I would more than not, I probably was faithful, and I tried to represent Christ. And of course, I got angry. There were times I cussed in games and practices. And then my teammate said, "Hey, Aaron, man, why'd you say that? Why'd you drop the F-bomb?" And I'm like, "I know, man. That's all me, you know." But what was cool is that as they were watching me, they would also say they would get disappointed when I did let them down. So if I was cussing, if I was having this outburst of anger, they're like, "Aaron, remember, you're a Christian," even though they weren't Christians. They respected the fact that myself and a few other of our teammates who were generally trying to be followers of Christ, they respected that. And you know what? You know what's amazing, Ian, is that even in those simple small acts, how God can use that. I can't tell you how many calls I got anywhere from 5 to 10 years later from former teammates who maybe they'd reach out to me on Facebook. It's like, "Hey man, can we meet? Can we chat? I want to run by you." And they would say, "Aaron, I want to thank you for being the example you were, man. I just gave my life to the Lord. And I'll just never forget your attitude, never forget what you did." And it was just not that we need validation, but it was just like, "Lord, man, thank you for using a fallen vessel like me, you know, that you could use a jabroni, a knucklehead, you know, like myself to bear witness." And so, yeah, I mean, of course, there, you know, on the relational side, yeah, there are temptations when you're a popular athlete and whatnot, and you got to say, "No, man, I'm not going to do that." You don't want to put yourself in certain situations. Yeah, so that happened, but I was pretty disciplined. And if it wasn't for football, you know, there's no way I probably would have went to university, or at least not for free. And so I was pretty, that kept me pretty disciplined as well. So I don't know if that answers your question, Ian.
Yeah, and again, so it just kind of makes me wonder what kind of course you thought you were heading on as you've got into uni. That's all paid for, presumed by a scholarship. It's a military academy, so were you looking to be a pro footballer? Were you looking to be in the forces, or did you always know deep down that ministry was your calling?
I always knew deep down ministry was my calling. Now, how did I get there? I wasn't quite aware. I had other opportunities to go play football at other schools, and at the time, again, as an 18-year-old, you don't have a macro view. You're not thinking of this, and this. For me, there was two things. I want to be in pastoral ministry, and I want to play on a good football team, and that was kind of the two priorities that I had. And at the time, the Air Force Academy was a top 25 team year in and year out, and so I went there for that. And I thought, oh, it'd be nice to have a guaranteed job after you graduate, which was nice. Coming out of high school, I wasn't quite sure if I was good enough to go to the pros. And then when I got to college, it became clear, like, I was a really good high school football player. When there are levels to these things, and while I was at a good level, there were just other players that I played against who were on another level. And that was, for me, a realization. I don't think I'm gonna go to the NFL. So let me just get that. I'll do the best I can, but get that expectation off. But like I said, for me, pastoral ministry was always a vision and whatnot. And that's when I ended up actually deciding to transfer. So I was at the Air Force for a few years, and I ended up transferring to Wheaton College. And part of the reason why was, the recruiting coach from the Air Force, and I don't think he meant to mislead. Maybe he did, I don't know. But I'd mentioned I want to be a pastor, I want to go to seminary as well afterwards. And he's like, "Oh yeah, the Air Force will pay for that, we'll cover it, no problem. And just come over here, play football with us." And I said, "Okay, cool." Well, I find out that the Air Force can pay for you to go to the seminary, but they want you to then be a chaplain and serve 10 to 15 years afterwards. And it was that, coming to that understanding where it dawned on me that, yeah, maybe I don't want to do that. I don't want to be in my mid 30s and then being able to leave enter the civilian world again. And so that's when I ended up transferring to Wheaton College, which is a liberal, Christian liberal arts school outside Chicago. And I spent my last 2 years of undergrad there. I met my, it was a, you know, if anything, not only the education, but the best thing that came out of that was I met my wife at Wheaton College. Thanks be to God. And then it was while we were in, you know, we continued in Chicago, and that's where I did seminary in Chicago as well. Yeah.
Cool. So I think I first came across you when you were thinking about coming to the UK to minister. But prior to that, you were involved in ministry in a couple of churches and church planting, and were linked to an organisation called the Creek Collective. We've interviewed a couple of guys from that. So. I think the Creek Collective is a bit like Medhurst and 20 Schemes, but for America and the black and brown communities in the US. Can you
Yes.
share a little bit about your ministry journey, how you went from going to seminary to getting involved into full-time ministry
Yeah.
to then to the UK?
Right. Yeah. A good question, brother. I would be delighted to. So when I was in seminary, we were going to a church at the time where I was able to serve in a ministry context, the director of young adult ministries. And we had it was a larger church by UK standards, even a bigger church by American standards. And while there, our senior pastor, he put the seed on my mind, Aaron, would you consider church planting? And that was the first time that I had actually had the thought, oh yeah, how do churches start? You know, how do they begin? And that began us, my wife and I, on a journey of, oh, could we church plant? And so we spent a year deliberating about that. I look back foolishly and maybe naively and arrogantly thought, you know what, I'm going to plant in downtown Chicago. I'm going to be the next Tim Keller. You know, then you realize, no, you're not him. But during, I think where the Lord took us as a family was showing us our cultural, ethnic, and even class background. Because prior to that, most of my Christian life was in white evangelical middle class spaces. And it wasn't until my mid-20s where I began to question and wonder, not in a critical way, but just, oh, how come I don't see the Latino sounds and smells and values in these churches that I'm a part of? How come I don't see that level of camaraderie and loyalty and love? And so the Lord led us and myself specifically on a journey. What does it mean that I am Mexican American, right? I'm not just white American, I'm Mexican American. And what does that mean for ministry? What does it mean the fact that I grew up in a working class immigrant context? And so from reading different scholars and theologians who are Latino evangelicals to even Indian and Black evangelicals, just reading through them, the Lord really pressed upon myself, hey, I think God is leading me to plant a church in an area that that is similar to what I grew up in Austin. And I'll never forget the drive. It was a February on a Tuesday in 2012, where again, maybe just had a few of these experiences in my life, Ian, where it just really feels that the Lord clearly, maybe not audibly, but just clearly spoke to me in a very direct way. And on that Tuesday drive to seminary, I felt God say, you're going to Austin, and you're going to go to East Austin specifically. You're going to go to the predominantly Black and brown community, working class. And so that then set us on that path. And that's what we did in God's kindness. Summer of 2014, we moved to Austin and planted a church with just a handful of us. We probably didn't have an idea of what was at stake in church planting. Didn't realize. I mean, when you're young, you're full of ambition and big confident faith, and you're not realizing, how am I going to get paid? How am I going to do this? How am I going to who am I going to reach out? I don't have any contacts. If anything, the Lord just had within me a conviction and a drive to grind and to be faithful and to work hard. And so that's what we did. And in God's kindness, we planted a church. And it was, again, in this context, which is predominantly Latino and African American, historically poor, working class immigrant, all those demographics together, And our church was never big. It was, at the earliest maybe 10. We got up, bigger through the years, and that was my heart. I felt alive serving there with we would say in Spanish, mi gente, mi pueblo, my people. And it was around 2020 when I did get connected with Pastor Thabiti Anibwile, and he and others. That's when he shared with me that they were thinking about starting the Creek Collective, and they were taking momentum in that direction. And they invited me to join that efforts, and so I joined the movement as well at that time. And it was great because, while I'm sure other orgs did exist, I wasn't aware of any orgs that specifically was trying to plant in these black and brown spaces in the US. Again, predominantly working class spaces in the US. I wasn't seeing that. And it was so refreshing to be with other pastors, but then to help find church planters and encourage them, and just realize we're going through the same things. We're going through having the same struggles and the same doubts. And look what's working for us over here. Hey, why don't you try to see if that could work with your context? And it was through one of my colleagues on the board of the Creek Collective, who introduced me to Pete Stewart, who's a 20 Schemes pastor in Glasgow. And so we then got connected there, and then that then opened up my connections with 20 Schemes, and then by extension, that's how you and I met, Ian. I mean, would it be helpful to talk about that journey of pastoring in America to coming over here?
Yeah, definitely. I think in particularly as well, it's interesting you were talking about like black and brown communities, African American and Hispanic, Latino, kind of working class, and often you just hear an ethnicity when you talk about US culture. It's like white, or then it would be another ethnicity.
Right.
Very rarely do you hear class get brought into it, but obviously, so my example in the UK is there's poor black and white people, and there's rich black and white people, and generally, the rich black and white people have more in common than
Yeah.
so for me growing up, I used to watch like Boys in the Hood and New Jack City, and I could relate to the African American guys who were living in the ghetto. Their life was more similar to mine than much of the things I would watch on the TV in the UK, looking at
Right.
white people like the Downton Abbeys, or when you were looking at police dramas and things like. The only time I could relate to people is if like the criminals were being arrested on the UK TV. And it's quite interesting when you talk about this like ethnic divides within the US. There's been a lot of tension. There's been things upon the border and
Right.
huge issues within the church, whether it was Kamala or Trump recently. And again, you've come to the UK at probably a similar time with similar tensions to what we're facing now with the migrants coming over on the boats and things like that. And I think there's a lot of issues being, I think, blamed on ethnicity when I personally think the issue comes from the elites of whether regardless of what ethnicity it is,
Right.
standing on the heads of the poor. And I wonder if that's the same in the US or different. What's your experience of class and ethnicity?
Yeah. Well, it's a good observation, and I can entirely understand what you're saying, because in the US, I think we've truncated culture and ethnicity into race, which I think irritates me, because we'll smash people's cultural ethnic backgrounds, and we'll just look at their phenotypes and say, you're black, you're white, you're brown. And I know I was using these terms interchangeably. That is one thing that I do appreciate about the UK, is I think there is a greater sense of particularities that I see within UK. We're willing to see that. There's differences. Like, just because you might have the same skin color doesn't mean that you're of the same group or the same tribe or the same ethnic. Like, there's differences, and that's good. Whereas in the US, we don't. And so because of that, the whole class conversation gets thrown out the window. Little do we realize that for a good number of African Americans and Latinos or Hispanic Americans, a good number are middle class and upper middle class. We're not a, we don't think that. We think that everyone who is of this type, with these phenotypes, is poor or working class. Like, actually, no, you go to certain cities and suburbs where you see loads of Black Americans and Latinos, and they're doing really well financially. They've climbed the social ladder, as it were. But in doing that, there is a major divide and distinction. What I found among Latinos is that the more economically advanced they are, the more they become critical and look down upon the working class Latinos. And so again, class, I think, is much more of a dividing force, is much more of a signifier, a powerful one, than just ethnicity or race. And I think Anthony Bradley, I've appreciated his work and his studies in the US. He has banged that drum a lot, that I was like, oh, Anthony, you're right. Like, class is the bigger issue here, and we should talk about that. But this is where the powers that be, I think, politically, where in America, and it's maybe to extent true here, is that politically, that these political heads and parties, they benefit off this scheme of Black, white, and brown tensions. You know, they don't want to address class. We want to keep. We benefit off of immigration, a broken system. We whether it's Republicans or Democrats, they benefit off a broken system, because they have that, they can then leverage that to speak to their base and gain votes and gain support. And both sides are guilty of it. I mean, I've been so frustrated with this, because there have been numerous times where the Republican Party and the Democratic Party have full control of the executive and the legislative branch, full control, and they did nothing with it. And that just revealed to me, like, they have no interest in wanting to, and maybe I'm being very overly critical, forgive me if I am, but it's like, there's no interest in wanting to reform these systems, because they can use it to benefit themselves. And perhaps that's true as well here in the UK. Now, I don't know, I'm not a political scholar here in the UK, so I wouldn't be confident, but what I have observed about the UK is that there is a growing sense, particularly for white working class folks, a growing sense of feeling, and they felt this way for a long time, but it's feeling neglected, overlooked, disenfranchised, uncared for by the political powers. And not only that, to make matters worse, also being blamed for the social ills of of the UK, which further alienates these communities. I've seen that. I've seen that in our community, in our church community right now. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, Ian, but I certainly have seen those dynamics. I think class is very much more pronounced here historically and presently than it is in the U.S. In the U.S., it's mainly race, which I think doesn't fully capture it. And partly, I think that's why, as I look back on our journey, seeing this firsthand, the Lord used that to get us to come here. And so I was given a sabbatical 3 or 4 years ago. And as an American, you have to forgive me, Ian. It was my first time to the UK. As an American, I thought everyone was like BBC. I think everyone talks like the BBC programs, whether it's Sherlock Holmes or what. And so we were up in the northeast of
You'll be
Scotland.
forgiven. You'll be forgiven for that, because most people within the church do. So, if you've only spoke to Christians, then that's probably the impression you'd have.
Well, I exactly. And so coming here, we had a sabbatical, and coming here, I was just blown away to see the diversity here. Diversity, particularly economically, and seeing how much class and the history of class has impacted different communities, and seeing how that impacts not only economic potential and educational potential, but just mindsets and cultures and values. I was unaware of that. And then also seeing how, when we were here, is how the Lord is also, like, it is in America, God is doing America, bringing the nations to the shores of England in the UK, but different nations as in the US. And so seeing that was like, oh, wow, I didn't know this. And so while we were here on sabbatical, now I know why churches are slow to give pastors sabbaticals, because sabbaticals have a way of clarifying and maybe even giving redirection to pastors. But while we were here, we just thought, wow, there's opportunities here for the gospel, for ministry, for places. And I remember thinking, Because we went to a couple football matches up in Aberdeen, and I remember thinking, how well are churches in Scotland or in England doing and engaging the people to come to these matches? How well? And I just begin to think, if it's like America, probably not well, because the church culturally is removed from working class peoples. And so they lack the cultural tool set. They lack the empathy required to engage, but then they also maybe even lack the compassion and love as well to engage with people who are of a lower class. And so there's this chasm, and so that just began laying put a seed in. And it wasn't until 2023, 2024, where my wife and I, we just began thinking, man, God is still working in our hearts to maybe similar to what he did in 2012, but working in our hearts. I'm calling you to move, prepare yourself. And we didn't know where, but we just felt this pull to the UK. And it was became clarifying as our time in Austin was come to an end. We had spent our 20s in Chicago, our 30s in Austin, where you're thinking, God, where might you have us in our 40s? And coming here on a few visits to just build connections and relationships. I met with pastors in Scotland, met with pastors throughout England, got connected with you, Ian, and others, and just similar, the voice, the refrain was, there are needs here. The harvest is plentiful here. The needs are great. Aaron, you could be used here, and that just set us on this trajectory, bro. And it wasn't until I think the spring of 2025 where God gave us the green light to actually pursue this and take these steps. And so that then set us on a journey of where in England. But yeah, that's how we're here, bro.
And numerous visits to the UK. Can you tell me which meal was your favorite? And
Oh, bro, head down. You know exactly what I'm saying.
what region showed the best hospitality?
For the listeners to know, there is this one spot. Well, I'm sure there's more in Middlesbrough, but there was this one joint you took us to where it was a chicken parma. Is that what you guys
Chicken
call?
parma, yeah.
Oh, chicken parma. Oh, delicious. I felt like I was eating manna itself, bro. Just that. Where did this stuff come from? It was fantastic. The Guinness was great up there. The hospitality was fantastic. Yeah.
Wonderful. Yeah. Oh, but I think just looking back at your time and again I spent time chatting with Dr. Anthony Bradley and looking at some of his work, and he talks about a poverty culture rather than a Latino culture or an African American culture or a, I don't know, would it be a trailer
Yeah.
park culture in the US, that people are of all ethnicities are united by a poverty culture. And he said that's
Yes.
probably why looking at things like Boys in the Hood translated well to me, because I was coming from that same culture. And universally throughout the world, that the same issues and some of the same blessings result from being part of that poverty culture, which is
Yeah.
interesting. You mentioned that some Latinos, as they do well for themselves financially, might look down on the less advantaged Latino community, which we have that in the UK, that class, higher class,
Yes.
looking down on the working class. And even people like myself, once you elevate yourself socially and economically, you can do the same to your own family, never mind that.
Yeah.
So I think what issues in the church did you face in the US dealing within, say, a multi-ethnic poverty culture? Because hey, I'll just pause a sec. So for me, Ephesians tells us that when all different tribes are brought together, different tongues are brought together, that's a manifold wisdom of God, that the manifold wisdom of God, that the angels, that the heavenly beings are looking down in wonder and awe
Yeah.
at how the cross has brought together people of different ethnicities, ages, men and women, young and old. It's
Amen.
brought everyone together. So how do we celebrate our culture and our identity, and have that flavor. You said you missed the flavor of the Latino culture within your church. So how do we encourage that and celebrate that? And not let it become something that's a source of pride, or out of something that becomes a source of derision once we climb up that social ladder. And has the church figured it out in the US or not? Still working on it.
Still working on it, brother. Still working
Yeah.
on it. And I think what complicates it in the US is you just have those political forces
Yeah.
and partisanship has a direct hold on many churches. And so I do appreciate that it's not in the same level of strength and intensity in the UK as it is church, because church is divided over politics in the US. But with that, I mean, even the politics, political differences, the gospel is powerful enough to unite people, right? The fact that Jesus, this is what always astounds me about Jesus, is that he had two of his disciples were on the opposite end of the political spectrum. You had a zealot on the one hand who actively was resisting the Roman Empire, maybe even fought to eliminate Roman soldiers and whatnot. And then on the other hand, you had a tax collector who was a beneficiary of the Roman Empire, who supported it. And yet these two people, under the lordship of Christ, those political differences do not become central realities and identity marks for them. Like their now central identity is Christ. And so the gospel has the power to do that. But how to do that? How do we do that now is a challenge. And I think you mentioned celebrating. I think what we need to do is acknowledge the fact that different isn't bad. Right. Actually, different is good. God made different. Genesis 1, God made all the trees according to their kinds, right? All the different types of animals according to their kinds. God himself loves diversity. And so we can celebrate our ethnicity, celebrate our culture, and even to a degree, I think even celebrate like one's nationality, to be proud of where they're coming from. And so we can celebrate the food, celebrate the music. But as you continue with the biblical story, you also realize the fall comes just shortly after, and that every culture is fallen. And so that keeps us humble. That should keep us humble, that no one culture is the supreme culture. What no one ethnicity or nation, because we're all fallen. We all got struggles. We all got idols. Our idols might be called the same from culture to culture, but their expressions might look differently. So greed is an idol that impacts both the rich and the poor. How it's expressed might be different. Bitterness and anger, jealousy, like all these vices and idols are present, but how they're expressed might look differently. And so that keeps us humble. And then we come to the redemption, what Christ does to redeem us and reconcile us back to the Father and giving us his Holy Spirit. And so we now have the power to be reunited, as it were, again, as people across class, across ethnicity. And so the way to do this as a church is, one, you got to be centered on the gospel. Like you can never depart from it, because the moment one does, that's when pride can easily sneak in and you start seeing this jockeying of our way is better. The way you do things is wrong. And you need the gospel to remind us, yeah, we will offend each other, and there will be miscommunication. There will be hurt feelings, but it's the gospel that reminds us, okay, let me go seek reconciliation. Let me go seek forgiveness. Let me humble myself and try to repair what was broken. And so we have the tools in Christ to be this community. It's not easy. Hard conversations need to be had, particularly right now in the UK among politics. It's okay for people to disagree. And I think this is where churches in our discipleship and spiritual formation, we need to be strong and clear is stressing the fact that we are first and foremost citizens of heaven. We that is where our main loyalty is. It's not to a political party, not even to a nation. And I know that's tough because we're very privileged to live in the West, and we have a history and there are benefits that we enjoy. But that's not even secondary, man. That's tertiary to our identity. Our primary identity is that we are citizens of the kingdom of God, and that needs to shape how we think about politics. That needs to shape how we think about one another. So there's space at the table of Christ to disagree. There's space to have different opinions, but we also must remember, we're not the enemies. We have a real enemy, but it's not my brother and my sister. We can disagree. We can disagree with charity and kindness. But this is where, again, the gospel must be so central to ministry, to the preaching of a church. because that is where we get the power. That's where we derive the strength to live as this community. Not easy, and it's not easy across class because people are different. And again, on paper, we love the idea of unity and diversity on paper, but it's when you're actually in the tangibles and the weeds, as it were, where our comforts start to get challenged with the way things are, the music in a service, what food is eaten, the language, how people smell, all these things. And we have to remember the gospel. I'm broken, I'm a sinner, yet God elected to love me, sent his son for me. I can ignore these my perceived inconveniences for the sake of living in unity with my brother and my sister. It's not easy, man, but man, I'm getting fired up right there, bro. I apologize.
No, that's awesome, brother. And I think it's a good place to end. But I think we've touched on a number of subjects that I'd love to, maybe three or four topics that we could look at more in depth in the future. From fatherlessness, I think that's a huge one that would be helpful. Again, you mentioned just how looking down on your culture once you become successful, rather than celebrating it. And again, that's something for me. What does a redeemed working class culture look like? Again, when you were speaking about the growing up in the projects, as a well, was it a Section 8, did you say it was? Project. So that you were talking about the struggles of it, the gang violence, but also the blessings, the loyalty, the friendship, the community. So again, it'd be fascinating to discuss a bit deeper on some of those subjects that we've been speaking about.
Let's do it, bro.
Yeah, nice one. And brother, I'll put a link to your church website. Is there any other links you'd like me to put up on to this podcast?
I mean, we just started a YouTube channel for people who want to hear, where the Lord is leading us in His Word. We have a Facebook channel. I mean, I'm rubbish when it comes to social media. So, but yeah, that the way website link will suffice.
Yeah, cool. Oh, Aaron, it's been a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks for joining me on the In Context podcast.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me in.
Cheers, bro.
Yep.